Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Dacia Eaton of KSKA, and by Skype, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Dermot, proponents of the referendum that would repeal Governor Parnell's revision of oil taxes say they have the 30,000 plus signatures necessary to put the measure on the 2014 ballot. What do you see?
Well, on Friday, the backers of the repeal effort said they had more than 40,000 signatures, and we don't know the exact number that they're going to submit, but they will submit those this weekend. And that is if, you know, most of those are valid, that's it, well in excess of what's required to get it on the ballot in 2014. So it will be some weeks before we know for certain that it will be on the ballot, because those signatures have to be verified and reviewed by the Division of Elections. But if the supporters are correct in that they have sufficient signatures, and so if this goes on the ballot, this is going to be one of the major issues of 2014. That is, whether the oil tax reduction approved by the legislature this year will be repealed or will it stay in effect. And this is going to be cloud the next legislative session too, because obviously this is going to take place in August 2014, which is after the session.
Let's get Steve in here briefly. Steve, you talked to one of the spokesmen for the organization.
Pat Levin.
Yeah, why don't you tell us what Mr. Levin told you?
Well, he was saying that they think that they've got between 45 and 46,000 signatures. They continue to come in, and it's good to have that pad. They need a little over 30,000 valid signatures to get the issue on the ballot in August of 2014, as Dermot said. So it's nice to have that pad, because, you know, you may have some people who are not registered voters who signed it. There may be some people from, you know, Louisiana who are up visiting. Sure, I'll sign anything, and they're not valid, obviously. But some will get tossed out. But it sounds like they've got a really nice pad there to perhaps get this thing and increase its chances of getting on the ballot. So this is a Friday at about noon that we're taping this. On Saturday at 3 o'clock, they're going to go down to the Division of Elections, and they're going to deliver all these petition booklets. Vic Fisher is going to lead the way. He's been one of the leading proponents of rescinding this new tax, SB 21, that was passed in the last legislative session. So if it winds up on the ballot, it could have a major impact on the campaign leading up into the August primary. People will be on the ballot, people who are running for office or re-election who approved this, supported this in the last legislative session, and they will be forced to defend this in their campaigns,
right,
including
right.
Governor Sean Parnell. He'll be in a contest with challenger Bill Walker. Now, Bill Walker is no slouch. He ran 3 years ago. He was on the ballot. And if I remember correctly, in the primary, he picked up about 35% of the vote. Not bad for somebody who didn't have a lot of name recognition and was considered by many to be a one issue candidate.
Gas line.
He wants the gas line. He's got some experience under his belt. People know who he is quite a bit better than 3 years ago, and he could use this as an issue to do some damage to Sean Parnell. So this is going to be a group of people who are going to be motivated to come out in what is notoriously a low turnout kind of a campaign election in August in the primary. So those who are motivated to come out usually win out.
Or they can make a big difference anyway.
They sure can.
Let's go back to Dermot. Dermot, speaking of oil taxes, tell us about a general accounting report. General Accounting Office report on oil taxes and the Alaska big corporations who do business here.
Well, Mike, it wasn't specifically about oil companies, but it was a sort of a general review of U.S. corporations and their effective tax rate as opposed to the posted tax rate. And this applies to the Alaska oil situation in this way. Of all of the statistical reviews of what Senate Bill 21 does, were based on the idea that there was a 35% federal tax rate for the corporations. The GAO report says that the effective tax rate for profitable U.S. corporations is far below that level. This is not exactly a surprise because it's been there are portions of the tax law that allow companies to reduce their taxes. But what it points out is that sort of the analysis presented to the legislature and the public was based on didn't really make clear that the 35% federal tax rate posted in all of the documents wasn't really what they were paying. This has the effect really of making the so-called government take percentages inaccurate or subject to error. In fact, because of the federal tax effective tax rate being lower, the government take for Alaska Oil is probably somewhat lower than reported.
Okay. Daisha, Assemblyman Dick Traney, just reelected this spring, wants to limit administration executive pay and benefits. Mayor Sullivan more or less says, forget it and stop interfering with the executive branch. What have you learned about this matter from your reporting?
Well, in an interesting turn of events, Assemblyman Dick Traney at Tuesday's assembly meeting turned the tables on the mayor's office and said, hey, you know, you put through this legislation, AO37 was the number, an ordinance linking union workers' pay to the inflation rate as a way to keep costs down for the municipality. And he said, hey, let's do this for executives too. And the mayor's office response was, whoa, wait a minute, let's do a study. So, and they brought in, the mayor's office brought in the chairperson for the municipality's Human Resources Advisory Board, and she spoke vehemently against this and said it's going to be so difficult to hire executives that are qualified if we, you know, are limiting their pay, and we need to step back and do a study. And the mayor said that they did a study of union workers' pay internally, so he would like to also do this for executives. The one thing that Dick Traney and other assembly members are very concerned about are these large leave packages that apparently have been given out in the municipality as a way to compensate people for working long hours.
They get this leave while they're working, and they may or may not use it until they leave. Is that how that works?
It's non-cashable leave, so they can't cash it out. But in some cases, it may, for instance, have someone working 10 months rather than 12 months. And what Traney and others are arguing is that, hey, this is still kind of, you know, costing us. And the mayor's office argues that, well, this is really the only way we can compensate our executive employees because we don't have overtime and we don't have all the perks of union workers.
Right.
So anyway, this thing is coming back before the assembly after a work session on August 9th to have continued testimony. And there was only one person, this chairperson for the Human Resources Advisory Board, who showed up to testify against it, and no one else spoke. So there may have been one or two other regulars, but it'll be interesting to see if anybody does show up and if they, you know, they can build any momentum behind this or not.
But it's going to take some time to play out.
It is. A few more weeks.
Steve, Governor Parnell is pushing the Obama administration and Congress. Surprise, the governor wants seismic research in the 1002 area of Anwar, the area not designated as wilderness by the Congress, to find out how much oil is below the surface. Why is the governor pushing this issue now in the face of steely opposition from the Secretary of the Interior and environmentalists?
Yeah, Secretary Sally Jewell in the Interior Department is drafting a management plan for Anwar, and testing is not part of it. Testing to see what oil reserves, gas reserves may lie below the 1002 area, that's not part of their management plan. So the governor wants this included. The governor says that this is part of the Alaska Native Lands settlement claim. ANILCA is what I'm doing. Yeah. He says it's in ANILCA that there needs to be regular updates of what energy may lie below Anwar, and there should be regular testing done. And he also says that technology today is much more accurate and has less of an impact on the land, and they can get a better idea of what is below Anwar. The last time there was an estimate done, it was done with, I think it was 2D seismic testing. testing, and they estimate that there's about 10 billion barrels of recoverable oil. They want to do it now with 3D seismic testing. The technology is much better these days than it was back then. So he wants the Interior Department to include this in the management plan.
Steve, I've been wondering, before 10 years ago, or even before that, as recently as maybe 5 years ago, there was an argument that we open Anwar, we won't be dependent on foreign oil, the Middle East, that argument. But now we're becoming less dependent on the Middle East. There's more oil. In fact, the world seems to be in a wash in this stuff, even though the price is still holding pretty strongly. How do they counter that argument?
I really don't know, Michael. And all this fracking that's going on in the lower 48, I mean, that's made the United States now one of the leading producers of oil in the world. And I really don't know how you do that. And you've got the Obama administration that's claiming that it says it's against this. You're not going to get very far, I imagine, in the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats. Democrats have certainly fought this over the years, going back to the days when Senator Stevens was raising the issue. At one time, they got Congress to approve this, but then it was Bill Clinton who vetoed it.
So twice, I believe.
Twice, right? And it was the Alaska National Interests Lands Claims Act, NILCA. I forget my acronyms now, but it was what it was in 1980. President Carter signed it into law, NILCA, and that expanded the size of ANWR as well as a lot of
and created the 1002 area.
And created the 1002 area, which has been under contention since I was
below
like
these
a
many
baby.
Years.
Yeah,
Dermot Cole, a forest fire near two rivers off the Chena Hot Springs Road near Fairbanks burns out of controls for days and forces many local residents to evacuate at least briefly. What is the status of the fire? Get us up to date.
Well, Mike, this is a fire that began about the third week of June on a military training area about 25 miles east of Fairbanks. It was probably caused by artillery training by the Army, which took place during a red flag warning. That's going to be, point of contention in the months ahead when the bills come due on the many millions of dollars that have been spent fighting this fire so far, as to why the Army was training at a time when the fire danger was so high. The Army has, after first saying agreeing that yes, it started from this training area. Later on, they waffled on that a bit and said, well, we're not so sure. We'll have to see whether or not we're responsible. Anyway, it did start an Army training area. It really flared up about a week or 10 days later when the weather got bad. It was really hot weather, dry weather, and windy. The fire is being fought now by 800 firefighters. At times, there's very thick smoke in that area. And several hundred people were evacuated from the Two Rivers area briefly.
If I might, early this approximately week. How close to Fairbanks is Two Rivers?
Oh, that's about 20 miles east of Fairbanks. And depending on the wind conditions, smoke can blow into town or not. Basically, the conditions have not been that bad right in Fairbanks. But in the surrounding area, it's still very smoky out there. This fire still can be very serious because hot weather is expected to return and it is not under control. It's sort of a very big area. It's black spruce, which burns really well.
Okay. And how often do fires of this significance come close to Fairbanks or come near Fairbanks?
Well, it's becoming an increasing problem, it seems like, as people move out and subdivisions expand. Every few years now, we've had a fire of some sort within smoking distance, let's say. The kind of worst one in recent years was in 2004. This has not been as bad as 2004, but it could very well be. I mean, if there's one bright side to this, it's that this ecosystem here has to burn every 100, 200, 300 years. That's just the way it works. And so this, you consider this as part of the natural process. And secondly, the people out in the Two Rivers area will have some measure of fire protection next year, this, meaning this won't happen again from that direction.
Now, there's a sales pitch. Let's all look on the bright side.
The moose are going to love it.
Okay.
But it's true.
Okay. Let's get Daisha back in here. Daisha, the Port of Anchorage is offering tours, but what's really getting attention at the port is the expansion, and for quite a while it hasn't been going so well.
Right. So every summer, for several summers, the port has offered these tours. I went on one. There are two more left, and one is coming up this Sunday, July 14th, and then again on August 11th. But what they highlighted is, the expansion got all this negative attention. Of course, they were telling me all the great things that were done, and there were some things that were done down there. One is they got a new barge berth. They got 2 miles of rail spur. They have a new road with direct access to Jay Bear and 60 acres of new land. And that 60 acres of new land is pretty important because they get 40% of
Not to mention, most of what you use in Alaska comes through that port, right?
Yeah, they say 90% of the goods in Alaska for 85% of the state come through that port. So meantime, I did put a request into the mayor's office and asked them, hey, what's happening with the port project, with this, debacle that happened with the pilings and the construction companies, and everybody's blaming everybody.
And the lawsuits.
And they said basically that the mayor is planning to have an internal meeting with the port and with some of the major customers of the port in August to let them know what's going on. And hopefully they'll let the public know at some point, too, we're hoping.
Okay, thank you. Steve, Sunday in Soldotna, two South Carolina families were killed in a sudden violent airplane crash at the local airport, and all 10 people died. What do investigators know at this point about this tragedy? And once again, we are speaking to you in the middle of the day on Friday. That's when we're recording.
There's not a whole lot known, at least not a whole lot that's been made public. And there have been some public pleas from the National Transportation Safety Board for any video that may have been shot, any pictures, any eyewitness accounts of this crash. They would love to have that to go along with their investigation. So they do know that they know which wing may have struck the airport, the runway first, and then it kind of nosed in. I believe they also know that the propellers were turning at the time, but that's about it that they've made public. The NTSB is meticulous with its investigations. They'll take the plane. I think they've already placed it in a hangar down in the Soldotna area, Kenai area, and they'll go through it and see what was working and what was not. They do have a kind of black box. It's not really a black box like you'd find on a big commercial jet, but it at least will tell them something about the attitude of the plane.
If I'm correct, there are no tapes from the control tower because there is no local control tower, right?
I think so. I don't know if there's a control tower or not, Michael. I'm not sure, but I don't believe there's any kind of recordings or anything like that. I think you're right on that. There's just one 5,000-foot runway that's there at that airport, and it's a small airport that really heats up, of course, in the summertime, when you have tours coming in and out and you've got the fishing season going on. So we'll know a little bit more, I think, next week. The NTSB always publishes sort of a preliminary report, and sometimes you can get a real idea of which way they're looking in their investigation from this preliminary report, and that'll be posted online sometime next week.
And before we part on this subject, tell us a little bit about the pilot.
Willie Radisky, he's the pilot. He's a lot of experience. He's a longtime Alaskan pilot, a good guy with a lot of friends and family left behind. Folks who are very sad about what happened, obviously. But by all counts, he's a very experienced, very good pilot. And I know there's a lot of folks down there who are going to miss him greatly, as well as the two families from South Carolina that perished in this. There have been numerous memorial services back east in South Carolina. One was held just yesterday for the children that were lost in this crash. So an incredibly sad event that happened down there.
Thank you, Steve. Daisha, you have been doing a series on how Anchorage School District cuts are coming down hard on immigrants and refugees who are in the school system, children, obviously. One of them is a very nice story on a Hmong student who is going to college.
Yeah, this woman's name is Peng Tao, and she was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. Her family was originally from Laos. Her father fought with the Americans during the Vietnam era. He's passed away. Her mother's gone back to Laos. But before her mom went back to Laos, she sent her daughter with her older brother to the U.S., and they ended up in Alaska in 2008. And here she was, speaking hardly any English.
Roughly how old was she when she got here?
I believe she was in eighth grade, and then she started high school barely speaking any English, you know, just what she picked up. And in that time period, she went into the top 10% of her class, and as a graduating senior at East High School, this past spring, she earned a scholarship to go to UAA because of that. She's very excited. She wants to be a nurse. She realizes it's going to be tough. She has a lot of determination, and she needs it because she was married at 15 in the Hmong traditional culture. Girls get married pretty young. Primary task is caring for the family. She already has two kids. And so she's up against a lot, but she made it to graduation of high school, and she said that's largely because of the help she got from a career resource advisor at East. And that career resource advisor was cut last year, and she helps many students. She averaged about 100 students a year, like Peng Tao. And not only was she cut, but they lost an ELL counselor and also a graduation support coach. And these support staff, these counselors, were put in place to help students like this.
And if these professionals are not in place, what's the alternative for the students, or is there one?
Well, they stay in high school and try to graduate on their own, or they drop out. The problem is a lot of them don't understand the American school system, and their parents, in some cases, don't speak English as well as they do. So they're really not there to guide them. So they need these adult counselors. And that's important at East in particular because they're the most diverse school in the district. 2,200 students, and they say about 20% officially get help with English, and more than half speak another language at home. So you can imagine how much they need this. Now, the school district made these cuts. They say they have to because the state legislature is starving them, and they plan to do so for the next few years, and there's going to be more cuts like this. They're trying to diversify the way that their counselors work in the school district by training them to be generalists and work with these students. Whether or not that will work or not, we're going to find out next year.
Okay, we will find out next year. Dermot, Fairbanks local government is wrestling with some thorny issues this summer. For one, the question of whether the borough employees and bring concealed firearms to work. And actually, we now have a decision on that last night. Tell us about this, and how did this become a hot topic in Fairbanks?
Well, every so often, people have to get worked up about a topic that doesn't really directly apply to local government, and this was one of them. Two assembly members who are particularly vocal gun rights supporters proposed ordinances to allow borough employees to carry weapons to work. There's a lot of controversy about this, a lot of emotion. They had a long hearing, a public hearing on a Thursday night. The assembly rejected the idea, but that didn't prevent a lot of people from getting very worked up about it on both sides, both those who say this is their right in the Constitution and those who say, well, it's really going to make the borough government a little intimidating if you go in there and you're dealing with the armed workforce. But the vote was 6-2, and I think we probably heard the last of this for a while. It does remind me about 20 some years ago, there was a resolution by the borough assembly, a member of the borough assembly, to require people to own guns. Now, it was a resolution, of course, so it wouldn't really do anything, but in the end, the assembly amended that, recommending that people own guns, not requiring them.
But they didn't recommend that their employees in the borough building bring them to work. Okay, that's what we got for the
right. So they're now that has been rejected. So
okay, yes. Steve, Medicaid fraud makes the news again. Yep. For the moment, this is at the caregiver level, small money or smaller money, but nevertheless, such fraud is very disturbing. What have investigators found out?
Well, there was a news conference held earlier in the week where it was the Alaska Medicaid Fraud Unit came out and said that they've filed charges against 29 people. 28 of them are caregivers. One is actually a person who receives Medicaid. And they said that these folks allegedly billed Medicaid for services that they didn't perform. For instance, they were putting down that they gave care to a Medicaid recipient, and at that time they were actually on vacation someplace else, or maybe they did a half hour's worth of care and they billed for 2 hours, something like that. But you're talking about $360,000 here that was allegedly bilked from the Medicaid fund. So these folks were registered through a group called Good Faith Services. They are now banned from billing Medicaid for any kind of services that they provide. And now, quite possibly, they could face jail time.
Are these misdemeanors or felonies, or does it depend on how much you took?
I guess it probably depends on how much you took. There are some folks who it was just kind of a pittance, but there are others who took tens of thousands of dollars, allegedly. So I think it probably depends on
felonies,
what's going on.
Yeah,
and there's jail time, quite possibly, that could come.
And what's
could
the
come
remedy in
this.
20 seconds?
The remedy, yeah. I think everybody's becoming more diligent. I think the fact that 29 people got caught up in all of this by the state, I think that's a pretty good remedy there. They say they're going to be a lot more diligent in keeping tabs on this.
Okay. Yeah. And our diligence requires us to note that the clock is telling us we're out of time. We'll see you in 2 weeks, or at least I will see you in 2 weeks. I'll be in Fairbanks next week. But Lori Townsend will be right here with Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.